Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. Just what scares a horror writer? It's a question that author Michael Schutz answers in this episode and connects to his newest book, Plank Children. Michael and I talk about the creepy cover he chose for the book and how he likes to take on his own fears when writing. We look at the true history that gets woven into the story and some of the tropes he worked to avoid in the writing process. We are diving into one of my favorite things, that is horror. I'm a huge horror nerd, whether it's movies, comics, or books, and it is the latter this week. I am talking to author Michael Schutz for his new book, Plank Children. It is his third release, and folks, you're going to want to check this one out because it is a real creep show. Michael, thank you for joining me. I am really happy to be talking about this.
Thank you, Max. It's my pleasure to be on, and thanks for liking the book so far.
Oh, dude.
I did my best.
You did an amazing job. So before we dive into the story, though, I want to talk about the cover, because book covers, for me, can either make or break a book. I have bought books strictly based on the cover. No joke.
Yes.
Or at least see it, and it's like, okay, I want to check it out. Okay, this sounds good. I'll buy it. So the cover.
We do judge a book by its cover. And we all know that, because so much goes into the creation of a cover. So we can lie, we can say, oh, don't judge a book by its cover. That's what a cover is for.
Exactly. And your cover is both like straightforward and also terrifying. It is two eyes looking out of a dark room, basically. Why'd you go for that for the cover?
That was my idea. Actually, pat myself on the back. It was my mom sent me a Halloween card years ago, and it was like cat eyes staring out of the darkness. And I thought, you know, that would make a great book cover someday. And then I came to Plank Children, and I'm writing Plank Children, and I realized that my main antagonist has green eyes, so that image came back to me, and I thought that would be really, really interesting. You know, sort of in the vein, pun intended, of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, that paperback original release, which was just solid black with the vampire face and that little red drop of blood.
Oh, I've seen that one. That's really good. Yeah, good point.
I thought just solid black cover, Elijah's green eyes staring out at the person, and then just in red, the title and my name. I just thought, you know, that will, you know, it's looking at you. You know, when people see it, it's looking at you.
The thing that I think is really creepy is that the eyes aren't malevolent. They're just staring. It's not even like, they're not like angry or sad. They're just staring. That's
odd. Just staring.
God. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. You know what? It kind of reminds me of that scene. I think it's from The Conjuring, when the woman is doing the little like clap game, and then behind her two hands pop out of the darkness and clap. I saw that. I screamed. I was like, fucking hell, Conjuring.
Yep. Yeah. That was, you know, and I hate watching previews because of this, because they give away like the scary parts, because that was in the original trailer. And the first time I saw the Conjuring preview, man, terrified. Yep. When that happened, that clapping thing, oh, man, I was sold.
Yeah, I was just like,
it chills right now.
I know, right? Yeah, it's so because right, like, it's so creepy that it's like right behind her, and there's no other noise. It's just hands reach out, clap. So, yeah, dude, so absolutely amazing cover. Definitely had me hooked. I'm curious, though, have you ever seen, has it ever happened to you where you've been like at the bookstore and you see a cover and you think, I'm buying it. I don't care what it's about.
I'm sure that there has been. I'm sure. But, you know, this is kind of like this. I would go to my local library has a book sale every first Saturday, and everything's a quarter, and it's just great. So that means that I go there and I just end up buying just anything that I ever possibly thought of owning. It's like, oh, I think I've heard of this author. I'll pick it up. And I saw a book, and the cover and the script, everything, it just looked like a New York Times best-selling. This is going to win the book award. This is going to be the Pulitzer Prize. So I picked it up because of that. It looked like one of those, you know, fancy New Yorker books. So, yeah, I've done that.
I love library book sales because I'll walk in and think, okay, Max, two books and that's it. Keep it to a limit. And I'll walk out with like a dozen at least.
Two. Wow. I go in saying a dozen and walk out with four bags worth.
Nice.
And that is no exaggeration.
Nice. Oh, yeah.
Bags, those... bags and bags. I'll tell you a story, though. I found my favorite John Steinbeck is East of Eden. That book actually helped me get sober many years ago. And I was at this library book sale and I found a hardcover for a quarter, you know, and it was an old one. It was from 1952. I thought, this is really amazing. So I bought it. I put it on the shelf. And a couple weeks later, apropos of nothing, it just dawned on me that East of Eden was one of Steinbeck's last ones. And I thought, 1952, it couldn't be. It's a first edition, East of Eden. There was an error in like the first printing, and I have the error printing.
That's your like retirement fund right there.
it's my best find to date.
Oh,
Just get
that thing like encased in glass and put it on your mantle.
It's just there. And it used to be right where the cats could get it. But then I decided, well, maybe I should put it up a little higher.
Yeah, not a bad idea. That may be the thing that like, you know, like buys you like your mansion someday. So I would take better care. Let's talk story now. And I'm going to adopt my movie voice so I can give everyone at home, the listeners at home, the rundown for this one. So Miles Baumgartner lost his boyfriend, his house, his job. Worst of all, he lost his nephew and Ian, his almost son, died, mangled in a car crash 9 months ago. So how is there a recent photo of Ian on Facebook? Miles follows a trail of rumors and half-truths to a long-abandoned orphanage in the Wisconsin North Woods. But St. Hamlin's is not as empty as he expected. Secrets haunt the shadowed halls. Horrors slink within darkened rooms. Snowbound, Miles hunts for the truth of what really happened to Ian and the children of that unholy place. They say that time heals all wounds, but time is running out for Miles. His personal demons have awakened. The terrors tighten their grip. To have any chance of starting a new life, he must escape before malignant forces curse him to walk eternally with the evils inhabiting St. Hamlin's.
Coming this fall.
Exactly right, yeah.
Great movie voice. You did that justice.
Exactly. Plank children. You can never escape. There's your poster. Your poster.
That's what I sign.
Yes.
The books when I sign them. Oh, did I? I probably signed yours then.
You did. And I read that and thought, oh, shit.
Sorry. I could have given you credit for that, but I didn't.
That's okay, Adisha. Always take credit for your good ideas. Your bad ideas, make them someone else's fault.
Someone else's. Wasn't me.
So one thing I was really curious about, is this based at all on any kind of true story or urban legend?
Absolutely. Everything's true in it. It happened to my uncle. Family tradition. All true. True story. Plank children. And I guess this kind of gives things away, but for your listeners only, I'll tell you what it is. No, Plank Children refers to an old practice, which I thought was just an urban legend, but I guess they really do it, postmortem photography, of when kids would die, the parents or sometimes the school would prop them up on planks, would tie them to planks and take a final photo, a final family photo or a final class picture. And I was reading Creepypasta one night, like my character Miles does, and I came across this thing about plank children and just creeped me out. you know, and they'll have pictures and they'll be, oh, you can tell that this one is actually a dead girl. And it's just, it was so creepy. And I stashed that away for a later use. And then I found the story to go along with it.
That is so fucked up.
Isn't it?
What the hell were they? So they would actually tie these kids to planks. And,
yeah.
And the family would take a picture with their dead child?
Yes.
Holy crap.
Well, I looked into it a little bit further, like, just recently. And I didn't think about this, but this was, like, around... This was in the 1900s, and back in the days when photographs were expensive. And they took a long time to expose and everything, and people just didn't have that opportunity. So there wasn't going to be a family photo otherwise. So I guess when the child passed, that was their opportunity to take that photograph. So I guess that was why. But it's so macabre.
It is. Jesus. It's so messed up, actually. Like, just from like a health standard, like, you want to be that close to a dead body? Good knows, Lord knows what you're going to get from it. But
also, I know back then, yeah.
That just
maggots falling down off of their head.
Oh, God.
Brush them off.
Bowels release at that moment.
Yeah. Timmy's really stinking over there. What's going on?
Also, jeez. This sounds like the opener to every horror movie ever. Like, hey, let's take a picture of the dead child. What could possibly happen? Oh, now the spirit's haunting us.
What could go wrong?
God. This actually reminds me of a horror movie. I forget the name. The story is that a woman has lost her child, and they're told of this secret, super ancient place where they can communicate with the child's spirit. You just can't open the door.
Yeah, the other door, I think, or the other side.
Yeah, you're right. And guess what happens? She opens the door.
Yeah.
And I would love it if there's a scene where, like, she says, I open the door, and the person says, I told you to not do that one thing. You're dumb.
Yeah.
You're very dumb. Yeah. You're going to die. I'm okay with it.
I know. It's like, and I try to keep my suspension of disbelief, and I try to think, well, okay, if that was my dead child and, you know, it was really communicating with me, but it's the one thing they said.
It's the only rule, the sole rule. You could just sit there and chat with them all day long. You could be like, hey, how's it going? How's the other side? What's up? The one thing that they tell them not to do, and of course she does it.
Follow directions. That's the problem.
Seriously. Oh, my God.
That's a pretty good movie, if I remember correctly.
It looks good. It looks good. Aside from the idiot parent who does the one thing they're not supposed to do, it looks like a really dope movie.
But then you think, it's like, well, why would she do that? And sometimes it just comes down to, well, because if she didn't, there'd be no movie.
You're right. Yeah, we've got to move sometimes the plot forward. So let's have the parent be just dumb as a post. So what about the world building for this one? You know, what went into just crafting the scene for all this?
Well, I am from Wisconsin.
Ah.
And I have this kind of idea. I'm nowhere near his level, God knows, but it would be really cool if I could do for Wisconsin what Stephen King did for Maine. Because who the hell knows anything about Maine but Stephen King, and now we all know about Maine. You know, and Peter Straub is from Wisconsin, but he moved over to the UK, and, you know, mostly he's identified with London and the UK now. So, I mean, there's nothing coming out of Wisconsin. So I thought that would make a nice setting, you know. And I mean, snowbound in the Wisconsin Northwoods, that's something that you don't read about every day. So what's really banal and, like, just so commonplace for me, you know, Wisconsin and the towns and everything, that's something really different for most people. So I like to do that. My previous novel, Edging, took place just outside of Milwaukee. First novel, Blood Vengeance, that was my San Francisco novel because that's where I moved to. But I'm getting comfortable writing about my home state.
Very cool, man. Very cool. Is there actually a place like St. Hamlin's in Wisconsin?
No, but the geography is all based on real places. If you're from Wisconsin and if you're from that area, you know the towns I'm talking of. You know, they have different names, but that's all. You know, you can kind of find your way around. But no, St. Hamlin's is sort of based on the Ohio State Reformatory, the place where they did Shawshank Redemption. You know, that place, that's really storied, and that was my original model for the place.
Now, we talked about this prior to the recording, and this is, you know, at the core of it, it's like a haunted house kind of story. Yeah. That's like the one thing that you get a little freaked out by. So what's it like essentially putting your fears on paper?
It's amazing. It's amazing because I am the biggest scaredy cat. I'm terrified of everything. And yeah, haunted houses are my kryptonite. Watching a haunted house movie, watching, you know, possession movies. It's that when it gets to be, you know, there's a haunting, and I think this was in Paranormal Activity, they bring the expert in and the expert says, well, you know, this isn't a ghost, it's actually a demon. Oh my God. Then I just completely lose it. Yeah, it's something that terrifies me. And it's funny because I know a lot of people will say to me, well, you're a horror writer, so I bet nothing scares you. Everything scares me. And think about it. Do you really want to read a scary novel by somebody that never gets afraid?
I imagine it would be more boring if it's kind of like if you were writing about something that didn't scare the crap out of you, you can't really get affected by it. If you can't get affected by it, how do you know if it's actually scary or not?
Yeah. So I was able to just go with a lot of the fears that I have, and yeah, just put a lot of the stuff that freaks me out into this book. And the response so far is that it's freaking other people out.
Nice, nice. Without giving away spoilers, is there a particular scene that really scares the hell out of you?
Not scares, but there is one that there's a couple that are really deeply disturbing. And there is one scene in particular that I wrote, and I figured at some point an editor is going to tell me that's too much and I'm going to have to take it out. And I said, but I'm not going to do that myself. I'm going to put it in there and I'm going to wait and see. And nobody ever told me to take it out, so it's in there.
Oh, what scene's that, man? Come on. A hint?
that's the scene in the incinerator.
Oh, geez. I haven't gotten to that yet, but now I want to flip ahead and find it.
That's towards the end. But there's it's interesting. We've been talking about being scared and scary. And I think this came from my love of movies and horror movies. It's hard to find a genuinely scary movie. Scary is hard. But I do a lot of lists and find disturbing movies, like top 10 most disturbing movies. And a good disturbing movie is also difficult to find. But when you haven't really been looking for them, then you have this whole stockpile. And I started getting interested in being disturbed. So really what I wanted to do with Plank Children was not so much write a scary book as a disturbing book. That's sort of the direction that I'm taking my work in now. Is that I want to be disturbing. I want to disturb someone. And so far, it seems that that's actually creating fear. People are saying, oh, God, this really terrified me. So that's wonderful. That's wonderful. But, yeah, so I just wrote some of the most disturbing stuff I could think of in this book. It all just flowed organically, and I just let it go.
You mentioned earlier about how it's hard to find a genuinely scary movie. Why do you think that is? Is it just that the genres are being kind of like tapped out?
I think so. I think that's a big part of it. I think that lately it's CGI is a big problem because you can see it that about halfway through a movie, you can tell that the filmmakers were so anxious to show their CGI monster that they're going to show it. And then they keep showing it. They show it again. Show it again. Show it again. And then you're just looking at this thing that you've seen in broad daylight, you know, nothing like, I mean, think about Ridley Scott in Alien and just how, I mean, it was just slick and goopy, just seeing parts of it hidden in the ship. Compared to like the last one he did, where it's just aliens jumping on the ship and you see them, and that's not scary, you know. No. So that's a big problem. People are in love with their CGI monsters and think that that's going to carry the day. A lot of filmmakers, I think, they don't realize that it's not the answer that is scary. It's the lead up to it. It's the tension before you find out. That's the scary thing. You got to go back to Alfred Hitchcock and look at the way that he constructed suspense and the different ways that you can do that. Because sometimes, you know, you keep it away from the audience, you know, like in Psycho, you don't know what's going on. But then in other Hitchcock ones, the audience gets to see it. You know, the audience sees the bomb in the train, but the characters don't. So, but either way, no matter what, it's the tension leading up to, and that is getting lost.
I agree with that, because especially with the overuse of CGI, because I think some of my scariest movies are the ones with just people, like The Grudge, for example. That's, I mean, they had some CGI for that, but mostly it's people. I think you could do some kind of creepy looking ghost. It's like, you know, skidding around on like all fours and skidding on the walls and the ceiling. It looks kind of cool, but is it scary or is it just, oh, that's kind of awesome?
Exactly. And I love what's Insidious did this. I'm a huge Rob Zombie fan. And I wonder, like, he gets a lot of hate, even in the horror community. I can't figure it out. He's a fucking genius. I love his work. The Lords of Salem, Insidious. There's a few movies where the camera will follow a character through the house, and there'll just be something standing that it just pans over. And you see it for a second. That's scary. You know, you get to see the thing. It shows it, but it's just... You could miss it if you're not looking carefully. You know, just things, it's like hiding, like, oh, you know, you could see something in the corner that the character doesn't see, but you only see it for a second. You know, that's scary.
Yeah, no, and I definitely agree with you about Rob Zombie. I think he's a bit of a unremarked genius when it comes to film. Like, I mean, of course, he's an amazing musician. I'm a huge White Zombie, Rob Zombie fan. But yeah, I think people think of him more for the music and less for the movies.
And I don't know anything about his music at all. But as a filmmaker, just genius.
Absolutely.
When I watched House of a Thousand Corpses, that opening scene was just, how tense and scary was that, with just Captain Spaulding being held up at gunpoint, and that was really scary and suspenseful in such a completely unexpected way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just this bombastic, scary looking convenience store, you know, guy in the middle of nowhere, and he's getting robbed, but he's the one that's controlling the situation. We're completely lost. We're out of our element. That was a lot of talent. Yeah. He had me from that.
Mm-hmm. I think, and I could be wrong about this, but I think for a lot of people, what kind of turned them off was when he did his version of Halloween.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people kind of like piled on him when he did that, because that's how it always is. When you see someone do a remake, there's always that, you know, find every flaw you can, tear them to shreds for it.
Yeah. I loved his Halloween. The thing that he did wrong with Halloween 2, because I know, you know, I'm the expert on this. No, I'm kidding. When he showed Michael Myers without his mask, when the helicopter's going over, and he's just this grunting homeless man, that's, I mean, everybody knows. I mean, John Carpenter talks about this every single Halloween. We see an interview where he talks about the mask makes, and Carpenter called him the Shape in the original Halloween movie. It's not Michael Myers, it's the Shape. You know, Michael Myers and that blank mask is a blank canvas on which all of our fears can be projected. You know, he's faceless. I love Michael Myers because he's so stiff. But then you see how he plans things and puts bodies and poses everything. So, you know, he's like actually really athletic to do this. But, you know, so that's what's scary about him. When you reduce him to just some guy being hunted by a helicopter, it's gone.
Let's jump back to the book now. Because
really? Do we have to talk about my book?
We don't have to, actually. We can just like nerd about like horror movies for the rest of the show. But I think we should probably segue back to the book a little bit. There we go. It's because people do want to kind of hear about it. You know, I mean,
we should probably
talk about it. this folks is pitching 101. Start with your thing. Talk about something else, and then eventually dovetail back to it.
Bring it back.
Brilliant. This is how you get your books made into movies, kids. This is how you do it. How does someone make a book scary where you don't have the visual aspect? How do you make something like this make people afraid to almost turn the page, but also want to turn it because they just have to see what happens next?
I don't know. That's my
great answer.
That is my greatest fear. When I sit down to write a new book and it's, okay, this is going to be a horror novel. How do I make it scary? How am I going to make it scary? And I am such a film fan. And I think, you know, in film, you can show things and you have music. It's like, how am I going to write a book that's scary? A lot of times what I will do is I will write out. I take copious notes longhand. I have, when I'm in the middle of a novel, I have like 3 Mead notebooks and post-its everywhere and 3x5 cards. I like making lists of things that frighten me. So I'm like, okay, well, this scares me. I can write about that. And also what we were saying before about the tension, because you can do that in writing, I think even better than in film. You can talk about the things that are leading up to what is going to be revealed. And you can take much more time and care in that tension. So I think it still scares me to wonder how I'm going to make this thing scary. But I think the secret is in writing the tension. And knowing that the scary thing is saying that there's something behind that door and describing the door. And people are going past the door. But you don't show what's behind the door yet. You know, you just make it so that people need to find out what's behind that door. But, oh my God, I don't want to find out what's behind that door.
Did you have any scenes here that were hard to write? Because either they, like, scared the crap out of you, or they may have just even disturbed you too much?
Nope. And when you read the book, you're going to think, oh my God. But no, it was perverse joy. Nope, I had so much fun with this. No. That I loved every minute of it.
I think that's how you know you got yourself a winner, that it was actually fun to write, that it wasn't like a slog to get it done.
I will tell you, though, that Plank Children as a book was the most difficult thing to write. When we're talking about the individual scenes and being disturbing, they were great. But putting this thing together and making the final product was the hardest thing I've ever done, hardest thing I've ever written. And I knew it took me 3-4 years to finally get it out. And I knew that if I could ever hold it in my hand and see Plank Children by Michael Schutz, I know that I can do anything now. That was hard. There were 2 complete rewrites. So 3 complete, basically different versions. The chapter order completely changed 3 times. It was very difficult to just piece together and get the book right. So maybe that's why I loved writing the disturbing scenes and the scary scenes so much, because I had a handle on that. That I knew. You know, the individual scenes, I knew what I wanted there.
How different is the final version from the first version?
Thematically, not too different. I'm trying to think now. But, I mean, basically, it's the same book. It's a lot of the details and a lot of, like, the reasoning, you know, trying to make, you know, why is the character doing this? that changed a lot. And, you know, like, why is this happening? And the history of the place. Originally, the backstory of St. Hamlin's was that it was a prison. I eventually got rid of that. And there was going to be this whole backstory about tuberculosis. But then I realized that I wanted to make kind of a family saga out of it. And having it during tuberculosis time period didn't make that work out. So I had to completely change that and set the backstory in a different time. Yeah, it was just a lot of tweaking.
I think that's a good change because I think the notion of like the haunted prison, we've seen that a lot in a lot of different movies. Yeah. Changing it, though, where it has a more personal connection, where Miles is basically chasing after his nephew, whom he thought was dead. How does that change the overall pacing of the book, though?
When we're talking about pacing, I think about my chapter order. And that was the pacing and where to put everything was very challenging. You know, I did have to, at one point, I really did have 3x5 cards with all the major points laid out on the floor. Was that Citizen Kane where he does that? Maybe not. But it was just laid out on the floor, and I just picked up the cards and placed them where they should go to find the order. So, yeah, the order of things, the pacing, that was a lot of trial and error. I honestly don't even remember if I started out writing Plank Children about this, but it became my novel Edging, my second book, is very much a novel about my marriage falling apart. And Plank Children took place, you know, I started writing it while my marriage was falling apart, and then it did fall apart. And, you know, like 4 years later, now I'm older and I'm trying to move on. So that got in the book. And so I put that in. So when we're talking about a personal connection, that, yeah. So Plank Children is very much, there's a lot of me in Miles and finding yourself at 40, whatever, and needing to move on. And because his personal relationship with his boyfriend, that plays a huge part. But then the grief about his nephew. It really affected the book a lot because I want the drama to be just as important. I kind of have this theory. I call it the drama, which I like to use as the skeleton over which I put the skin of horror. I like to have a solid dramatic element that propels the character and characters forward. That usually speaks to me very personally, and hopefully it hits other people too, you know, because I think we've all had really bad breakups. I think we've all, you know, found somebody that we really thought, oh, this is the one, and then it explodes. It's like, holy shit. What do I do now? We've all had somebody extremely dear to us die, and you wonder, oh my God, what now? And using that to juxtapose the horrors, you know, just the outright horrors that come at him while he's trying to come to terms with his loss and his grief. So, yeah.
And I could definitely see that in the early chapters where we're meeting Miles, we're seeing the state of his life, meeting his family, you know, Ian's parents, and seeing what they're going through. I could definitely feel that you were taking a lot of real life experiences and putting them in the story.
Yeah, it was very cathartic to write. And I did a guest blog on Nicholas Kaufman's site. That was like the scariest part of writing. And the scariest part of writing Plank Children was being so personal. You know, and laying it on the line of, you know, what it's like to be now 45 years old and single with these failed relationships. And it's like, oh, my God. And just a lot of Miles's neuroses. Yeah, it's easy enough to write a scary story and to write about that. But when you get into the personal stuff and to just say, you know, to make this book work, to make it true in like the Hemingway sense, you know, it has to be true, really need to tap into personal emotions. And I think that readers sense that and connect with that.
Like, what made you want to say, okay, yes, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to kind of feature my own relationship situations in edging. I'm going to put my own family life in Plank Children.
Catharsis, really. I found long ago that I suffer from, I work with depression and anxiety, and I'm super sensitive. I take things really hard. And I learned that in my writing, if I take something really difficult, really hard in any way, and I fictionalize it, I put it on paper, I can cope with it better. It's like suddenly it's outside of me. Suddenly it's a story. So when it came time for Plank Children, I was primed for that. I was ready to say, Miles is going to have a bunch of my history in here, and I'm just going to carve out all that jealousy and hate and vitriol and spite and fear and the tears. I'm just going to put it all on paper and get it outside of me. I do want to note that I am admitting that there is a lot of autobiographical stuff in there, but still it is fiction. And, you know, lots of things happen to other people that I attribute to Miles, and, you know, so don't read it thinking, oh, well, this is Michael. But at the same time, I mean, there is a lot of personal stuff in there too.
I mean, Miles, Michael, there's a bit of crossover there.
You know, honestly, Miles Baumgartner is a reference to Peter Straub's If You Could See Me Now. I love that book. It had a huge effect on me, and the main character is Miles. So until you pointed out Miles, Michael, I didn't even think about it. You busted me. I came to a realization. It's like, do I owe you for the hour now?
Yes. I'll bill you later. You worked with an editor for this book. Did you also have beta readers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did they significantly alter the book's course, or was it more like making small, like more nuanced changes?
A little of both. I have one beta reader. Hello, Carol. Love Carol. She isn't a writer. She's a reader, and she loves all the same stuff as I do. We met via a Dexter Facebook game. And so I sent her an early draft of my first novel, and she like helped me out a lot. She's one of my biggest helpers. I'll send her an early draft, and from a reader standpoint, she'll say, this doesn't work. She changed something in edging so significantly that I never would have caught. She's like, you can't do that. And she helped me with Plank Children, and another writer friend of mine, M.F. Wall, she read a later draft and just did such a thorough job, you know, just pointing out things and helping me shape it down. So sometimes beta readers give just little nuances, and sometimes I think even sometimes we as writers, or maybe I should just say I like to give it to certain people because I know they're going to pat me on the back. But I also give it to people that are going to be real. And I know different people that are going to be real in different ways. You know, I know that this person is going to come at me from a writing standpoint. It's going to say, you know, you know, your syntax is all fucked up, Michael. You know, and then I can give it to other people and they'll say, you know, the story really falls apart there because that character wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. So, yeah. So beta readers are vital to me. I like to get it out there. And yeah, got to get some reception feedback.
Okay. Have you ever been in a situation where either an editor or a beta reader says you should do this thing, change this thing, and you got to put your foot down and say, no, I want to keep it?
Yep.
Wow. Yeah. You are ready for that question, sir.
Because I am one stubborn son of a bitch. I am the people throughout my life have told me that my major problem is that I always have to be right. And I know that because I am. I do have to be right. And I see that in myself, and I try to curb it. I try very hard to let that go. But yeah, it's in me. So that happens a lot. People tell me that I need to change it, and I'll say no. About half the time to 75% of the time, I come to my senses and I realize, okay, she was right. But, you know, there is that percentage where I know that it's going to work. In Plaint Children, it was the thought asides that Miles has throughout the book, quotations from other books pop into his mind. And I had a lot of people tell me that I needed to reference those every time. Otherwise, people were going to be lost. You know, I had to attribute that and say, well, you know, he's that's from this, and this is a reference to that. And I just said, no, because I'm trying to write so deeply from Miles's point of view, and these are quotations that are just popping into his mind. It's not true to the book. He wouldn't be referencing them to himself. And I did concede enough to let people know that are reading it that that's what's going on. So in the beginning, you know, I do reference some. I do put it in the context. I do let people know what's going on more than I did originally. But at the heart of it, I just left the quotations there to just pop in. And I decided I will live or die by this. If people hate it, then I did wrong. And I won't do that again. But if I'm right, then good. But I was going to live or die by that.
Hey, we all have our line in the sand. I want to talk now about horror villains. Of course, this book, you know, it's got some doozies here. Yeah. What to you, though, makes a good horror villain?
Being relatable. Villains are the heroes of their own story. And a lot of people don't realize that. I see that in movies. I see that in books. I see that in just people walking around. They think that the villain is just villainous. But, you know, Darth Vader doesn't know that he's a villain. Darth Vader is working for the Emperor. He's doing his job. And you know, in my book, the chaplain, he's trying to save these kids, you know. I think that's what makes a good villain is that when you can see that in their heart, they think that they're doing right, or at least they started out doing right. You know, it's never an answer that, well, you know, the villain did that because he's crazy. No, he did that because his mother died at the hospital because the doctor botched it up, and that's why he hates the medical profession now. There's a reason, you know. That's what makes a good villain.
Mm-hmm.
The craziest shit possible.
I've never really heard it said like that, but it makes a lot of sense because particularly in horror movies, the bad guy in a lot of cases is just this arbitrary demonic spirit. Like, in some cases you can tell they just cobble this together from some legends or they pull it out of their ass. When you don't put much thought into the villain, how can you make them scary? How can you make them connectable?
Yeah, exactly. And you can make them more villainous and more scary when you understand them. When you know that they think that they're trying to do good, you can think, oh my goodness, so now I know their mindset. I know what twisted them. I know what they think that they're doing. So follow this logic down. What else would they do? And usually I come up with even crazier shit. I mean, look at Hellraiser. I think it kind of depends on there's so many movies, but, you know, basically, you know, Clive Barker, you know, he talked about, I mean, Pinhead was somebody who went after the box. The people that go after Le Marchand's box are seeking pleasure and pain that leads to pleasure. And then they get caught up in this. And I think that's fascinating. I don't know if I'm putting my foot in my mouth or not, because then there's the other aspect of Hellraiser where the Cenobites are kind of like the disciples of hell and they're the lords of hell and they, you know, but at least partially the villains, quote unquote, of Hellraiser are people that wanted to seek, you know, the ultimate pleasure and to find pain and pleasure together. Like in the second movie, the twisted psychiatrist, you know, he's all twisted and they just fuck him up just terribly. And he's all like all mangled. And he looks out and he says, "To think I hesitated." It's like, oh my God, just blow my mind. Not, oh my God, I can't believe I wanted this. No, can't believe I hesitated. Damn.
So do you think the villain in your book is a cut and dry bad guy, or is it more complicated?
Much more complicated. Much more complicated, both of them. I think that in both cases, because there's the Superintendent Tram and there's Chaplain Allen, and they sort of play off each other. They both have different reasons for doing it. And I'll admit that it took me, it was easier to find out why Chaplain Allen was doing the things he was. It was harder for me to understand Tram and where he was coming from. Chaplain, maybe more so, is a little bit more understandable. He has more of a human side. I think that I ended up making Tram pretty much a vile person, but he did have his reasons. You know, he was sort of a damaged person. You know, I think Chaplain Allen started off with the best of intentions and just slowly got warped. Tram started off from a different place. He didn't have a heart of gold ever, but still not cut and dry villain, bad guy either. I mean, I like to create nuance in the villains no matter what. Even if, you know, they don't have anything redeemable, they should at least have reasons.
I really hope folks at home are taking notes, because this is such good stuff, though. And you make a lot of great points, I think, especially with the bad guys. If you just make it demon and that's it, it's like, well, okay, well, clearly, this is an obstacle for our hero to get over.
Yeah.
But that's it. There's nothing else to it.
Because that demon is trying to accomplish something, too. The demon is not just an obstacle for the good guy. The good guy is the obstacle for the demon, because that, you know, the demon is trying to do something that our hero is trying to thwart. How frustrating is that? You know, why is the demon doing that? You know, has the demon been like, I think it's the vampire Armand, when we learned that particular sect of vampires were like holed up in hollow trees and like worshipped, and like once a year they were fed blood. You know, I mean, that's like, oh my goodness, you know, this demon that's possessing the house, has he been like stranded in some corner of hell, unable to do anything, get anywhere, and suddenly he's out and now he can, you know, just go crazy, he can feel his appetites, he's hungry, he's horny, you know, oh my goodness, he's released on the world. Yeah, I mean, it's not just some demon that the good guy has to get over.
Or is the demon actually innocent? Like, did being in hell twist them into becoming a demon?
Yes.
Did they somehow get tricked into going to hell for some, because the devil is a trickster? Did they get tricked into going to hell, and then with the experience there, twist their whole psyche?
Yes. Oh, exactly. In my first novel, Blood Vengeance, it has partially to do with this killer of young girls, and their souls have been trapped in this shabby tenderloin studio apartment for so long that their innocence is being eroded, and the pure innocence of their souls is starting to rot, and they're becoming villainous. They're at that point where they are going to start becoming demons if something doesn't happen to change that.
I want to ask about the journey of from, you know, concept to finished product, to getting this thing out there to the world. I've heard a lot about how folks who will go through like 20, 30, 40 rejection letters before they finally find a home for the book. Yeah. What was it like for you to try and find a spot for this?
That is a really interesting question, because it starts with my first novel was published by Permuted Press. They had some problems and they lost a lot of authors. And I stayed with them through that book. And they had originally said they wanted edging for my follow-up, but then they dropped me. And one of the authors that left Permuted Press, she, along with her husband, started their own publishing company, Burning Willow Press. So when I got edging back, guess who I'm going to go to? And Ed and Kendra were wonderful. I loved them. They did a great job with edging. Plaint Children is all theirs. I just had to finish it. And as I've said before, it was insanely difficult to finish. And Ed was wonderful. He's like, just take your time. Take your time. Make it the best. We'll publish it when you get it. Unfortunately, they had to shut their doors. Really sad, because I really wanted it. But so suddenly Plank Children was a free agent. So I had to go looking again, and there was a press that a lot of people from Burning Willow were going to. So I submitted it, and Three Furies Press, they accepted it and put it out.
Did you submit this to like other companies? Did you cast your net as wide as possible just in case?
I did send it out to a few, but I liked the idea of going with a smaller press. The idea of a smaller press will give you more personal attention. So I did that route. With edging, actually, because my second novel, of course, also became a free agent when Burning Willow had to close down. I did send that out to some agents, kind of feel the water, but I eventually just self-published that one. You know, self-publishing is getting to be just more and more and more of a legitimate option. You know, you just start wondering, why am I sharing 80% of my royalties with somebody else when I can do this? You know, I mean, the thing is, you have to, if you're going to self-publish, hopefully you're hiring the best freelance editor you can, and you hire the best formatter that you can. It still takes a lot of effort, but it's not like it used to be. So yeah, I really liked ending up self-publishing edging and trying to work on a collection of short stories that I think I'm just going to self-publish myself. Mm. But
yeah, I would say around half the authors that I speak to are all self-published, and they have their reasons. In some cases, it's because they hit so many walls, they decide, well, I still want to publish this thing, so I'll just do myself. And you're right. Like, the game has changed a lot, where before it was such a hassle. Now there's so many ways to do it that you can do, like, a print-on-demand service. It's changed a lot, where now it's way more feasible.
It is. And when you deal with a lot of the smaller presses, it does get to the point where you start thinking, there really isn't that much of a difference now. You know, if I can hire the people to get me across the line, if I do that, then I might as well have control, ultimate control over my book. And that's a very attractive, prospect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Set your own price. You can set your own discounts. You could, do your own promotion. And again, with smaller and smaller presses, writers have to do their own promotion more and more anyway. So there's less and less of a reason not to go ahead and self-publish. And I don't think that readers really care as much as they used to. I think there used to be a stigma. Well, there did used to be a stigma. And I think that's going away now.
How good would you say are you at being a self-promoter?
Fair to middling.
Good answer. I like that. It's honest.
I've certainly learned a lot by now, this being my third one. I've met a lot of great writers and people on the publishing side that have helped out. It's hard. It is really hard to know how to promote your own book. It is. But, you got to contact good people like you, and come on these great podcasts, and you gotta watch what other people are doing, see what works.
One thing I saw checking out your site is you are very media savvy. Like, I saw, interview on this podcast, this radio show, this and that. So it's like, you definitely know how to play that media game. And I think it's important for anyone who's publishing a book or putting out an album or making their own movie. You gotta know who to reach out to so that you can help spread the word about what you're doing. Because your Facebook posts and your Twitter posts and your Instagram, that's only going to go so far.
Yeah, that is so true. That, and it's very, very limited. And I know with my first book, I thought that was going to be that was it. You know, it's like, oh, I'll just promote it on Facebook and everything. And at that time, back in whenever the hell that was, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, I don't know. I saw a lot of writers were doing that. I saw them just pound social media. You know, you get to be a member of 30 different horror groups and writers groups and post on every single one of them. But then you realize that everybody else is a member of those. So you're just contacting and pounding the same people over and over and over. And there have been lots of studies that say that people just don't buy books from social media. You have to go out, like you were saying, where readers, viewers, where an audience is going to go to find stuff. Where are they going to go to be like, well, I'd like to find a book. Where are they going to go? And go there. And thank you for saying those kind words. I feel like I'm still kind of splashing around in the kiddie pool, but I do what I can to get the word out, and it's not all me. I have so many friends giving me lists of people to contact, you know.
In fact, now's a good time to mention our mutual contact, Ben Eads.
Yes.
He's actually one who kind of got us connected, and he's an amazing writer. Check out his book, Hollow Heart. I said it before, I'll say it again. The cover of his book is one of the few covers I would print out as a poster.
And speaking of wanting to self-publish and hiring the best people and hiring, you know, a freelance editor, I will not hire anyone to edit my work except for Ben Eads.
Really? Wow.
Just point blank. He's fantastic. The first time we ever spoke, we got into a Skype conversation. We talked for 2.5 hours, and I learned more about writing and technique than, you know, from him in those 2.5 hours than in everything leading up to that. As good as I'm doing now in my writing is because of Ben Eads. You know, he took me to another level. So if anybody's out there looking for an editor, you know, check him out. See if he fills up really fast, because people want him. He's in a lot of demand. Mm-hmm. But if you could get him when he has an open slot, man, he's good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You talked earlier about how this was a challenge to complete, you know, Plank Children being a bit tough to kind of finish off. When did you know you were done? When did you know that it was time to stop the tweaking and ship it off?
The day that it came out.
Well, there we go. It's like, so I can't fix anything now? You're saying it's too late.
That was a little bit of conflict with my editors and publishers, was that I was trying to tweak stuff right up until the end. I'm terrible about that normally. Just, I can always find something. Plank Children was definitely, I started submitting it because I realized if I don't start submitting it, it's just never going to reach an end point. It's just always, it's going to be that the Michael Douglas work from Wonder Boys, where it's like 700,000 pages of manuscript that just won't end. So yeah, with Plank Children, it's like still looking through it now, being like, okay, when I get the rights back and self-publish this one, I think I'll change that. And man, I missed something there. And, oh God, I can't believe I described it like that. So it's never ending. This book.
We truly are our worst critics. Truly.
Yeah.
Whenever I listen to myself doing this show, I'll think, oh, that's a stupid question. Why'd you say it like that? You're dumb and you're awful and people hate you. I'm good at beating myself up, actually. I'm very good at that.
That's terrible, Max. Oh, my God.
I'm, you know, it's a thing. I'm working on it little by little. I'm trying to, you know, feel better about myself. Actually, since we're talking about this, what would be your advice for someone who is having a hard time putting that pen down and declaring it done?
I thought you were going, I have advice for people to get working, but to call it done, relate, you know, beta readers like that. I mean, give it to people. Do not, you can't be your own judge. You've got to let people in. Let other people guide you. You know, talk to some friends, hit people up, you know, ask if they'll read it. It's because it can be hard to know if you're in a vacuum, just yourself. If you're really having trouble, you know, sometimes you know when it goes easily enough and you know when it's done. But if you're really having trouble, you know, reach out, let some people read it, see what they say, get some advice. Yeah.
When you see that you've got reviews on like Amazon or Goodreads or what have you, are you the type of person to run to the computer and check them out? Or do you
Nice. I wonder if the people that say they don't are really being honest. I would have a hard time.
I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I would have a hard time.
Like Stephen King, you know, at this point, probably not. I mean, you'll pick up the paper and see what the New York Times says or something.
Really?
But I want to know. I want to know. And a lot of time, you know, getting the feedback is good. I love that so many of the reviews of Plank Children are from people that what they're saying, they really got it. And that's an incredible feeling. I've never felt that so much as with this book and some of the people that have reached out and told me how they feel, that they really got it. It's like, wow, it's like all the little nuances that I was trying to get across. It's like people have caught on to that. Wow, that's fantastic. You know? And if it's a bad review, after you write nasty letters in your head, you know, see if there's any validity to it. Cool down and take a look. It's like, well, maybe that's true. Maybe you did do that. Mm-hmm. Don't do it again. You know, if the same criticism keeps coming up, so, you know, negative reviews can be very important. But just don't comment. Don't ever comment on reviews. Just don't.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. You talk about the people who get it. I think Ben's the review that you have on the back of the book, where he describes the book as relevant. Ben gets it. People could say, oh, you know, scary as hell or had me hooked. And those can be true, but they're also a little generic. So for Ben to say relevant, it's like, yeah, Ben gets it. He absolutely got it.
Yeah. I loved his relevant is really, really important because you don't want to. It's that whole thing of deciding to write or make a movie or whatever your medium is as an artist to say, oh, this is popular, I'm going to do that. You know, and you have to be original. And when that originality resonates, that's, you know, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's a good feeling. And it's important.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is becoming the Ben Eads show again. Ben is awesome. Read his stuff right now. The end.
Oh, but maybe I'll get some free editing out of it.
There you go. Yeah, and maybe I'll get some free books out of it. So, you know, it's a plus side. So what is next for you? Now that this is done, it's out there, the world's seeing it, they're loving it. What's next for you?
Novellas.
Oh, really?
Novellas. I love novellas. I have one that's done. It's a sci-fi piece. And I'm shopping that around. I have one novella that's done in rough draft and one that I'm still working on. It's a fantastic length, especially for horror. You know, you get more into it than short stories, but not so many characters and subplots as a novel. It can be really lean and mean and effective. So I have lots of projects. Saying what's next for me is scary because I just kind of divide my time too much. But I think I mentioned earlier, I really do want to put out some short stories. I'd really like to get a collection of short stories out. So that might actually be next. But then look for some novellas from me.
Well, Michael, man, thank you for joining me. I've had a great time talking about all this stuff. And folks at home, you can learn more at Michael Schutz Fiction, that's SCHUTZ fiction.com. Buy yourself a copy of Plank Children. You get this in ebook format, print. He'll sign it. You can't escape once you do that.
And you wouldn't want to.
You would not want to, absolutely. So, Mike, thank you once again, man, and definitely looking forward to what's next.
Thank you, Max.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter and mental health advocate Stephanie Mathias. Be sure to check out my single Hero Side, available on all platforms now, and listen to Citywide Blackout, your home for the best indie artists.
Picture this. You finished your first book and nailed it. The plot, the characters, all the twists and turns. This one's a winner, and all you need is the right cover. If you've got my art skills, this is the part where panic usually sets in. Enter the cover villain. Hero to writers everywhere. Founded by noted author Remy Flagg, Cover Villain focuses on composite image covers for science fiction and fantasy writers. Give them the details, and they'll craft a cover using popular trends that everyone will want to see. But wait, you say, I've got ideas of my own. No problem, as Cover Villain loves a good collaboration. As they say, our goal is to put a little villain in every cover we make. Want to know more? Then head to covervillain.com and follow them on Facebook and Instagram.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. As always, keep those ears open.